This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا رافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب رب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel attacks on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip persist as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war enters its 137th day, despite global appeals for a ceasefire. Israeli occupation forces conduct raids on different areas of the West Bank, resulting in injuries and abductions of Palestinians in the occupied territories. And the International Court for Justice to hold a second day of hearing on Israeli atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territory since 1967. Thanks for joining us. Israel carries on with its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip as the death toll in the territory tops 29,000, most of them women and children. Israeli strikes targeted the Nusayrat refugee camp, killing several civilians. Regime warplanes also bombed other neighborhoods across the territory. The Indonesian and Al-Amal hospitals were also targeted as the regime continued its unrelenting onslaught on Gaza health sector. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said the situation inside the Al-Amal hospital is highly dangerous after 28 days of a continued siege imposed on it by the Israeli army. It said Israeli forces targeted and damaged a water desalination station at the hospital, warning that the available drinking water is only sufficient for 3 days. A member of the Islamic Jihad movement has hailed what he calls unprecedented losses inflicted on the Israeli regime by Palestinian resistance movements.
Despite its limited military equipment, the Palestinian resistance has inflicted heavy losses on the Israeli enemy, part of which the regime has admitted. The Israeli regime struggles to underreport its losses in order to keep the soldiers and settlers spread up. The more Israeli assaults against the Palestinian nation and the Gaza Strip, the more losses the regime will suffer.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Alu Abu Shaheen said the Israeli regime is not able to hide the casualties that it has suffered in the Gaza war. The member of the Political Bureau of the Islamic Jihad rejected Israeli allegations that the resistance uses hospitals as operation headquarters. He said the regime levels such allegations to justify its bombardment of mosques and health centers. Ali Abu Shaheen said the fact that regime forces invaded hospitals to find no resistance fighters reveals that the Palestinian movements do not use civilian infrastructure for military operations. Meanwhile, Israel has confirmed the death of one more of its soldiers in clashes with Palestinian resistance fighters in the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli military says the soldier succumbed to injuries that he sustained several days ago in southern Gaza. The latest fatality brings to 236, the number of Israeli soldiers killed in Gaza since the regime began its ground invasion of the blockaded territory in November. Palestinian resistance groups, however, say the actual number is much higher. They say the regime undercounts its losses amid fears of the Israeli public anger. The chorus of warnings is growing louder every day against the planned Israeli ground incursion into the refugee-packed city of Rafah in Gaza. In a joint statement, EU foreign ministers said the offensive would worsen an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. They said that it would also prevent the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. The ministers called for an immediate humanitarian pause that would lead to a lasting ceasefire. Hungary, a close ally of the Israeli regime, was the sole country that did not sign up. The EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell described the invasion of Rafah as a violation of humanitarian law, while the Irish foreign minister called it unconscionable. Some 1.5 million refugees are crammed into Rafah on the southern edge of Gaza after being repeatedly displaced by the Israeli onslaught. Israeli troops have stormed several areas across the West Bank as part of daily raids in the occupied territories. Regime forces raided Beit Amr, north of Al-Khalil, Tubas near Nablus, the towns of Kfar Nama and Sinjil near Ramallah, as well as several areas in Jenin and Al-Quds. They shot and injured several Palestinians following clashes with them. Israeli soldiers also abducted a number of Palestinians and deployed military reinforcements in the areas. Violence has been on the rise across the occupied territories since the regime started its genocidal war on the besieged Gaza Strip in early October. Nearly 390 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers in the West Bank since then. Earlier, we were joined by a correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for an update on the Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank. She told us about fresh raids on Ramallah, Jenin, and Nablus, as well as new settler attacks against Palestinians.
In Ramallah, the Israelis stormed the area of Al-Tiri, and there had been young Palestinians succeeded to throw Molotov cocktails at the Israeli vehicles while they were retreating from Al-Tiri area. A number of Palestinians had been arrested. Also in the town of Sinjin near Ramallah, the settlers raided Sinjin and attacked the Palestinians. Homes there. The settlers also burnt a house there in Sinjin. In the Jenin area, specifically in Brooklyn, this village, the Israelis stormed before dawn this town, and the clashes have taken place between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces. That, of course, they raided the Brooklyn area in order to arrest more Palestinians, as the Israeli forces had been doing every day and almost at night across the occupied West Bank. In the village of Burqa, northwest Nablus, the settlers had raided after midnight this village, Burqa, northwest Nablus, and they burnt at least two Palestinians' vehicles and two Palestinians' homes, while they also attacked the Palestinians there. The Israeli forces stormed the village of Burqa, closed all the entrances to the village, and they fired heavy tear gas at the Palestinians there.
Get the latest on the situation in the Gaza Strip. We cross on over now to Dera Bala. Correspondent Mutia Bamsaba joins us. What do you have for us?
Actually, it was another harsh night for the Palestinian civilians in Gaza Strip as this genocidal war enters its 137 consecutive days with more airstrikes and more attacks. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Deir el-Balah city, two residential buildings were destroyed over the last night, claiming the lives of at least four Palestinian civilians after the Israeli occupation warplanes destroyed those houses. And in addition to that, in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, another residential building was destroyed as well. One Palestinian civilian was killed over that attack, and it's worth mentioning that dozens of the Palestinian civilians were reportedly injured over those continuous Israeli attacks and airstrikes. Meanwhile, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling at the eastern parts of Deir el-Balah city. Heavy bombardments and attacks were heard here from where we are standing right now over the last night. In Gaza City, the Israeli occupation warplanes renewed their attacks on Al-Zaytun and As-Sabra neighborhoods, they were under heavy bombardments and several residential buildings were destroyed. At least three residential buildings were targeted and destroyed by those air strikes, leaving at least five Palestinian civilians killed in addition to dozens of the Palestinian injuries. Part of them are still trapped, and part of those casualties are still trapped under the rubble of the destroyed houses, while the eastern part of Gaza City also witnessed a heavy bombardment of the Israeli artillery that maintained shelling those areas amid fierce clashes and gunfights between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces. In the meantime, it's worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation forces allowed limited amounts of the humanitarian aid to reach the outskirts of Gaza City to the south. And they enforced those trucks to unload those humanitarian aid near the Israeli tanks and the Israeli checkpoints initiated in those areas. And despite the heavy gunfire of those Israeli tanks, the Palestinian civilians who are hit by the starvation and the famine managed to have an access to those basic humanitarian needs, particularly the white flour, mentioning that the Palestinian people there are deprived of that flour for at least a month. They didn't eat a flour or bread alongside with their families and their children. They managed to extract the white flour from under the Israeli tanks and under the heavy gunfire of those Israeli tanks. This reflects how catastrophic the humanitarian conditions inside Gaza City.
Thank you very much for that. We're going to end it there. That was, of course, one of Mutiaba Mustafa talking to us from Darabala. The top UN court at The Hague has opened public hearings on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. Addressing the tribunal, Palestine's envoy to the UN said that international law has never protected Palestinians.
Israeli leaders no longer feel the need to hide their intentions. They speak openly of getting rid of the Palestinian people one way or another. They defy the law, and the law is barely fighting back. For Palestine, the law continues to be only a measure of the severity of breaches, rather than a catalyst for action and accountability. What does international law mean for Palestinian children in Gaza today? It has protected neither them nor their childhood. It has not protected their families or communities. It has not protected their lives or limbs, their hopes or homes.
Mansour said the Palestinian people have faced attempts to push them out of their territories for 75 years. He demanded Palestine's occupation come to an immediate and unconditional end. Meanwhile, the legal representative of the State of Palestine focused on the consequences of Israel's breaches of international law. Over 50 states, including Iran, participate in the oral proceedings before the International Court of Justice. At the request of the UN General Assembly, the ICJ will then issue a non-binding advisory opinion on the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. Last month, the court issued a provisional ruling in a case brought by South Africa against Israel. It called on Israel to cease all activities that could constitute genocide in Gaza. However, according to the UN Special Rapporteur, Israel appears to be in breach of that order. The Yemeni army has released video footage showing the debris of a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone that it has shot down. The footage also shows the moment that the drone was hit off the coast of Yemen and its pieces being pulled out of the sea. Two U.S. officials have confirmed that an Air Force MQ-9 Reaper drone was shot down in the Red Sea. This is the second time since November 2023 that Yemeni forces have taken out a Reaper drone. On Monday, Yemeni forces also targeted two U.S. ships and a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. The Yemeni army spokesman said the British vessel later sank. Yahya Sari stressed that the army would continue to target U.S. and U.K. vessels in response to attacks by the two countries on Yemen and in solidarity with the Palestinians.
In yet another operation against Western interests in support of Palestinian in war-torn Gaza, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of the British vessel Roby Mar in the Gulf of Aden with naval missiles. The reprisal operation resulted in damage and complete cessation of its functioning.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God, carried out a military operation targeting a British ship in the Gulf of Aden, Roby Mar, with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The results of the operation were the following. The ship was seriously damaged, causing it to stop completely. As a result of the extensive damage the ship suffered, it is now at risk of sinking in the Gulf of Aden. During the operation, we made sure that the ship's crew exited safely.
The Yemeni army also shut down an American MQ-9 drone in Hodeidah while it was engaged in hostile actions against the Arab country. Experts interpret this operation as a message to the US and the UK that Yemeni naval operations will continue until Israel ends its genocidal war in Gaza.
The military operations carried out by the Yemeni naval forces and their targeting of American ships and drones will not stop unless the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. This is a new victory for the Yemeni army. Indeed, we are not strong in the face of the world, but we trust that God is the one who supports us.
Yemenis have asserted that the retaliatory operations will not end as long as the Gaza war and all-out U.S. support for Israelis continue. Since the start of the Israeli military campaign against the Gaza Strip, the Yemeni army has conducted naval operations against Israeli-bound vessels in solidarity with the Palestinians. They have also launched numerous ballistic missiles against the occupied territories of Palestine.
Observers say the American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group has not succeeded in halting the Yemeni army's naval operations. They believe that the US and the UK will eventually come to realize that halting the Israeli genocide in Gaza is the only way to protect their interests in the volatile region.
And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life
an increase for me in every good, and death and ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups, neglecting that this would reinforce the dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that, in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddie was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Keddie highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American University lecturer Yervant Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Halliday. John Foran from the University of California in Santa Barbara focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran, as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Halliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development, like others too. He too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Halliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence-seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Halliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda Salafists. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. In February, the Islamic world marks the 75th anniversary of the assassination of the Islamic scholar, thinker and activist Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. This week's episode will explore the contributions al-Banna made to Islamic revivalism, his legacy in terms of both the Brotherhood and wider Islamic movements. We look at the factors that led to his assassination. First, let's take a closer look at the life of the man himself, Sheikh Hassan al-Banna.
Hassan al-Banna, one of the most influential figures of the 20th century, a man whose ideas continue to outlive him until this day. But who was he exactly? Banna was born on the 14th of October, 1906, in Mahmoudia, a rural Nile Delta town about an hour's drive from Alexandria in Egypt. His father, Ahmed Abd al-Rahman al-Banna al-Sati, was a sheikh and a mosque teacher and had a massive influence on shaping the spiritual beliefs of his young son, who took great interest in studying Islam from his youth. Bana also began to be drawn into the growing nationalist political currents that were widespread at the time, as Egyptian society fought to throw off the yoke of colonialist control and subjugation that had Egypt and much of the Muslim world in its grips. At the tender age of 17, he moved to Cairo to continue his Islamic studies at the Darul Uloom Seminary, and it was whilst there that he learned the abolition of the Ottoman Caliphate, a development that deeply moved him. Combined with the ever-encroaching menace of British cultural colonialism, Bana began to see a spiritual sickness in Egyptian society and began to publicly preach and call to Islam in the cafes and streets. Then in 1928, along with disgruntled workers from the Suez Canal Company, Bana established the Muslim Brotherhood, a fraternity for Muslims who were increasingly frustrated by the oppression they were facing at the time. Over the coming decades, the Brotherhood had grown to having over 500,000 members, and its popularity had grown to other nations too. But the growing popularity and activism of Bana brought him into conflict with the Egyptian authorities, who feared the Brotherhood was planning a coup. The monarchy cracked down on the Brotherhood, and al-Bana was assassinated on the 12th of February 1949 at the age of 42, but leaving behind a legacy that has remained until this day.
Joining us today in the studio to talk about this historic figure is a regular contributor to the show, Betul Sabeti. Sister Betul is a political activist and commentator whose incisive analysis helps laymen and professionals alike navigate political dynamics on a global scale. We're also honoured to be joined by Dr. Mohammed Ghanim, a member of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, their political party, and he's also a specialist in Islamic economics. Thank you to you both for joining us. I would like to begin with you first, Dr. Mohammed. Who exactly was Hassan al-Banna? Tell us more about his family and his ideological background, please.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Hassan al-Banna was like anybody else in the world. He is a product of the society. We understand Hassan al-Banna by understanding the society at that time. That time was Farouk system, the king Farouk system, and the country was corrupted, was a dictatorship. Although there is a difference between Farouk dictatorship and today's dictatorship. Hassan al-Banna, from the background of qualified Sharia scholar, he felt obliged to sort the situation in Egypt. And you can't sort this any society problem overnight. And he had the idea is to create a close group, and those group will be qualified enough to reach the other member of the society in order to solve the problem of the Egyptian society at that time.
Now, Sister Betul, I'd like to come to you and, of course, and ask you a question about your views, in particular with regards to the influence of Hassan al-Banna when he established the Muslim Brotherhood. What were the conditions that Muslims faced, particularly at that point in history?
Right, so we're talking about the establishment of the Brotherhood a decade post-World War I. Now, World War I was a huge turning point in the region. You're talking about the essential demise of the Ottoman Empire. Of course, that in no small part was precipitated due to the Arabs carrying out the dirty work of the West, essentially. Whilst in the meantime, they were conspiring to carve up the whole region, you know, under the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement. So, you know, this was Britain and France that essentially carved up that whole region. So that was the situation that was prevailing at that time. Egypt was slightly different, though, because Egypt was already under the British colonial rule from since 1882, I believe. So it wasn't officially under the Ottoman rule, and it had its independence in that sense, but then the British took over before that. But ultimately, the situation of the Muslim Ummah was that it was completely defeatist at that time. It rejected the colonialism It felt a sense of despair. It felt enslaved. It felt like ultimately its dignity had been stripped away from it, right? It wanted to do something about it. It wanted to create change. It was an unfortunate state of affairs, but then this shows you the importance of the emergence of a man like Hassan al-Banna and the movement of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it's defined as essentially the first movement of its kind. It's defined as the mother of all of the Islamist movements that emerged since then. So someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna, he felt the responsibility of Islam on his shoulders. He believed that Islam can really provide a solution to all the problems, and that actually the Quran is the constitution that should be ruling in society. So that was kind of the ideology that he had, especially when we're talking about an occupation, we're talking about British and French occupation that was unwanted, that was essentially rejected by the people, that was inherently violent. So someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna sought to mobilize the Ummah. Now, the Muslim Ummah, the seeds of Islam was strong within the Ummah, but it didn't per se have a level of awareness. It didn't have a level of insight, a level of direction. So it really kind of needed that direction. So someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna and the party that he created came on board, and it began to develop political, social and cultural institutions within the society that could really focus on removing those elements of hopelessness and infusing the Islamic spirit, bringing about action and getting rid of that defeatist mentality. So some of the practical actions that someone like Shahid Hassan al-Banna took was he got involved in national action from day one. You know, so he mass mobilized protests, you know, on the streets against the colonial rule, demonstrations. He set up the Muslim Youth Association in 1927, which by their own admission is basically looking to promote morality in society, to enjoin good and forbid evil, which is a very important tenet within the Islamic faith. And actually, that was the seed that led to the formation of the Brotherhood the year later in 1928. And in 1933, I believe you had the Muslim Sisters version of the Brotherhood organization. And also a key feature of the Brotherhood was also to bring about this kind of ideological revolution in society. So they had their own newspapers. The first article that they published was called Salt al-Dawah, you know, the call to Dawah. Mm-hmm. Ad-Dawah ila Allah. Yes, it was the call to Dawah. That was the name of the first article that they published in Al-Fatah newspaper. And in fact, the last article that they published, I believe, was in 1947 in the Daily Ikhwan newspaper. So they had their own newspaper that they would publish in every single day. And that was the last works of Shahid Hassan al-Banna. And the article was titled Between Resilience and Tribulations. And that was a month, actually, before the party itself was dissolved by the British-backed monarchy, and 1 year before Shahid Hassan al-Banna himself was assassinated.
Sure. And, of course, he has been a hugely inspiring figure to other people, Dr. Muhammad. But how about the man himself, Hassan al-Banna? Who were the influences that inspired him in his life and works?
Well, I've heard some, in that time was Aziz al-Masri, but he wasn't really influenced by him. He was rather influenced by the Sharia. He was a very clever person. He was qualified in Sharia, and he was memorizing the Quran, and his life was completely surrounded by Sharia. And he find the way, the only way to change the situation in Egypt to the better is by try to follow Sharia. But again, to follow Sharia, you need some close circle. From those close circle, we convey the Sharia rules and this close member to convey it to the rest of the society. And once the society understands the Sharia rule and try to practice it, all the problem was solved. This is what his opinion, and this is what he started from.
Fascinating to hear that perspective there, Doctor. Now, of course, as we've been discussing, Hassan al-Banna's greatest legacy was the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood. We look deeper now into the history of the movement, its achievements, and the mark it's left on the world.
The Muslim Brotherhood was established in 1928 as a reaction to the fall of the Ottoman Empire, British colonial rule of Ottoman territory, and the looming occupation of Palestine, considered the second holiest land in the world to Muslims. Sensitivities towards British colonial rule crystallized in the form of an Islamic political movement. Concerned with the well-being of his nation, who has been left neglected and exploited by the British occupiers, Hassan al-Banna, Islamic scholar and schoolteacher, spread the ideas of a pan-Islamic, faith-based social movement. At its core, it looked after the vulnerable in society by providing much-needed social services like educational programs that taught the illiterate, setting up hospitals and businesses, and aimed to end British colonial reign and, in its place, establish a state run by Sharia law. Although he did not have the resources to make this a reality, it was an idea that enveloped him. Through grassroots activism, he organized local groups and began rallying support for a new movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. The radical ideals of making the Quran the country's constitution spread like wildfire across Egypt. This was made possible by the pre-existing, deeply rooted Islamic faith and practices of the Egyptian people. As the Brotherhood spread rapidly throughout Sudan, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and North Africa in Egypt, the movement launched protests against the ruling Waft Party. An armed element of the group took to more violent acts, including bombing and political assassination, to achieve their aims, which by this stage had deviated from its founder's will. Hassan al-Banna was assassinated 20 years after the formation of the party in 1949, and soon after, the Brotherhood retreated underground due to governmental crackdowns. Six of its leaders were tried and executed for treason, and many others were imprisoned. In the 1960s and 70s, the Brotherhood's activities remained largely clandestine. However, the organization officially renounced violence. In the 1980s, the Muslim Brotherhood experienced a renewal as part of the general upsurge of religious activity in Islamic countries, most notably as a result of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. With Hosni Mubarak forced to step down as president in 2011, the way was cleared for the Muslim Brotherhood's open participation in Egyptian politics, and they were finally elected as Egypt's government. Sadly, this was short-lived. With the coup of 2013, leading members of the Brotherhood were imprisoned, vilified, suppressed, and supporters even sentenced to death. Later that year, the Muslim Brotherhood was officially designated a terrorist organization in Egypt. Despite the crackdowns, the Muslim Brotherhood cannot be erased from the history of the region and remain relevant in their most active offshoot group, Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyah in Palestine, most commonly known as Hamas.
Now, Dr. Mohammed, if we can pick it up with yourself, what sort of opposition did al-Banna face, particularly from authorities in his native Egypt?
Well, to cut the story short, it's always dictatorship doesn't like people to influence the political situation. Dictatorship built a situation which he, the only person can conduct the policies and make the most beneficial of the social and economic system. And that he was influenced by that. And that itself, the dictatorship, never benefit any society. They lead society in order for the dictator to use the sources or resources of the country to make the rest of the country sleep deep in ignorance. And by that time, Egypt was completely, or not completely, a huge percentage was ignorance, in particular in religious, although there was Azhar, and where there's a lot of people memorizing the Quran, but the spirit inside them was very weak to follow the Sharia rules. And Hassan al-Banna had that energy on him to renew what is being left in Egyptian society to follow Sharia rules. And that was considered by the dictatorship a movement against him. That was the struggle between anybody at that time looking to solve any problem of the Egyptian society and the dictatorship. And that was the struggle between the system at that time and Hassan al-Banna and his movement and his follower.
Now, Betul, I'd like to return back to yourself and see the influence that Hassan al-Banna had on other movements across the Islamic world. In particular, we can look, for example, at the Islamic Revolution in Iran and many of the senior figures within that revolution crediting Banna for some of the ideological or philosophical inspirations with regards to their own successes.
Right, so if we're talking in terms of influence, the first notable point to make is first, Egypt as a country, right? So Egypt is a large country. It's got a large population. Egypt was one of those entities that actually wasn't carved up under Sykes-Picot, so it wasn't inherently under Ottoman rule at that period of time. If you look at the country, it also has like the real components of a country. You know, we're talking about legacy, we're talking about civilization, we're talking about history. You know, when someone thinks of Egypt, they think of a center of education, they think of Al-Azhar, they think of literature, you know, they think of humanities. You know, you think of those great Arab and, you know, Muslim intellectuals, a lot of them come from Egypt. So if you were to compare that with some of the other countries in the region, especially those that came out of the Ottoman Empire and then into British colonial and French rule, they didn't necessarily carry that same weight and that same influence. And so nor would you expect a kind of party of this kind or a kind of movement of that kind to emerge from that. You know, for example, if you consider a country like Lebanon, you know, it was like a baby, it was newly formed, it was literally carved out of Syria, for example. So naturally you'd expect Egypt to have that influence on the surrounding region. And the way I would characterize Egypt, it was like almost like that center of gravity in the region. So that was expected. But ultimately, and the reality as it transpired was that they weren't able to bring about this substantial change of shifting the status quo and getting rid of the British-backed monarchy, because it's not just a wish that you have in mind, right? When we look at political action and bringing about a kind of revolutionary substantial change, that requires understanding in depth the conditions of society. That recognizes it's almost like a political science of its kind. You know, you're not going to get that through reading Islamic literature, for example. That is a science of its own. And so you have to understand the conditions of society and how you can apply Islam to that directly. So the way that I would characterize a movement like Ikhwan al-Muslimin, like the Muslim Brotherhood, is they took the reformist approach rather than the transformist approach. You know, so they focused on the partial issues. They focused on let's correcting behaviors in society. Let's focus on correcting norms or rules or ideas, for example. So we should you know, open up charities, for example. We should support those who are impoverished, or we should, you know, shut down centres or pubs where they sell alcohol, for example, or nightclubs, for instance. This was the kind of trajectory that they were going in. Whereas if you look at an entity like the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's an example of one that took about a transformative approach. It's this idea that we have to completely shift the unjust status quo on the ground. This constitution, this Western-backed monarchy that was put in this position of power, and its secular constitution needs to be removed. We need to be governed, and we need to live under the rules of Sharia, of course, and this was something that was only achieved through the people. It was like the masses called for that change, and the people were the vehicle through which Imam Khomeini managed to establish the Islamic Revolution, which is a crucial point. So here we want to make a distinction between what like the ideological thinking of the Muslim Brotherhood was and its direction and its trajectory versus on the ground what it was able to achieve. Now, when we go to about 1948, this was a very sensitive and pivotal moment in history as well. So the first pivotal moment, we said, was the end of World War I, the demise of the Ottoman Empire, British colonial colonial and French colonial rule ascending. And then the second most pivotal point is basically at the end of World War II, where you have the British colonial yoke that is essentially rescinding, and you have America rising onto the helm of leadership. And America actually supporting the liberation movements on the ground, because you had this struggle and this conflict for that next decade between Britain and primarily Britain, and America vying for power in that region and that transfer of power. So, for example, in a country like Iraq, you saw how, you know, Malik Faisal was deposed and you had the revolution of Abdul Karim Qasim. Likewise, in Egypt, you had Malik Farouk, who was deposed, and you had someone like Jamal Abdel Nasser rising to power. So the establishment of this kind of secular republic. And if we analyze a movement like the Brotherhood, it was spreading throughout the region. You had similar organizations that were being formed that had the same weight, essentially, as the Muslim Brotherhood in countries like Iraq, in Jordan, for example, in Syria, its branches, essentially. Although the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood was such that it was more decentralized than centralized. Yeah. So in countries like Iraq, they had more of a kind of independence as opposed to directly having to answer the Egyptian leadership. Yeah.
And I think something that's interesting here as well is, you know, you've mentioned, for example, the Iranians, Imam Khomeini, and one thing he's always focused on has been unity between Muslims. And if we can just very quickly, we don't have a lot of time on the show, but discuss what Muslims can maybe learn from Hassan al-Banna and his approach about how Muslims should unite against a common enemy, in particular when you see what's happening to our brothers and sisters in Palestine at the moment.
Absolutely. So there were three key themes that Shahid Hassan al-Banna focused on, specifically when it comes to the Palestinian struggle for liberation. The first was that he centralized the Palestinian cause as ultimately the cause of the Ummah. You know, this idea that don't think of Palestine as a nationalistic cause, as the borders as per constructed by the superpowers themselves and the colonialists. This is an Islamic duty. It's an Islamic responsibility for every single Muslim to consider the burden on their own shoulders. And he made this very clear. The second point was the unconditional support for the Palestinian liberation cause. And he did not distinguish on the basis of anything. You know, this was very, very clear that every single one of those Palestinians fighting for their land, and that constitutes Muslims of all denominations, Christians and Jews, right, the indigenous people of the land, we need to give them our unconditional support. And the third point that he stressed upon is that we need to boycott those entities that are responsible, essentially, for sponsoring the Israeli occupation entity. Now, it's very important that we mentioned that Shahid Hassan al-Banna established this party in the 20s. So we're talking about prior 1948, you know. We're talking about when the Balfour Declaration was the kind of baseline, so to speak. And he emphasized that, you know, this Zionist project is a project that's just not limited to Palestine. You know, by their own admission, it's from the Nile to the Euphrates. Every single one of the Arabs has to see it as an existential threat and issue, because the idea is that they want to expand this beyond, and it's inherently expansionist. Yeah. So if I can just quote one of Shahid Hassan al-Banna's quotes regarding Palestine. He says in 1939, "The blood that stained the land of Palestine, the thousands of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of the highest Islamic ideal, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the sanctity of which was violated, all of these call upon you, O Muslim brother and sister, to sacrifice for the sake of God the soul and money he gave you, so that you may be worthy of the name of Islam." Essentially. So this is no different to what the Islamic Republic is calling today.
What the Islamic Republic is calling for, what other movements are calling for, and how relevant it is today 100%. In 2024, that we see the exact same or even worse oppression happening, and Muslims should be responding to this call. Sister Batul, thank you again so much, as always, for joining us, and Dr. Muhammad as well. And thank you to you at home. We hope that you will join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime is starving Gaza. Palestinian children are going without food for days as aid convoys are increasingly denied permits to enter. The United Nations estimates that nearly one in every 10 Palestinian children in Gaza under 5 years old is now acutely malnourished. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Zionist regime is starving Gaza. The United Nations estimates that nearly one in every 10 Palestinian children in Gaza under 5 years old is now acutely malnourished." Stefan Dojarik, spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, told reporters on February 2nd that the agency's partners have indicated a sharp rise in acute malnutrition across the population in Gaza, with a 12-fold increase compared to the rate recorded before the Zionist regime's attacks. There are only 70 to 100 trucks entering Gaza per day in the best-case scenario, with only two of those trucks going to the northern governorates. According to estimates by the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor, before the Zionist regime's attacks began in October, approximately 500 trucks entered Gaza each day. Lima Bostami, legal department director at Euromed, said, "What enters the strip does not meet the minimum level of the population's needs in light of the severe, continuous, and accumulated deprivation of food, drinking water, and medicine supplies amid this growing need due to the ongoing siege and genocide. The situation is getting more complicated because the people living in the Gaza Strip are under siege from all sides, making it impossible for them to produce the food they need locally or get it from other sources." Last month, the International Court of Justice